I'm Dr. Amalia Gonyas-Malka. Welcome to Womanity, Woman in Unity, the show that celebrates women's milestone achievements in their struggle for liberation, self-emancipation, human rights, democracy, and much more. Joining us today is Professor Tarina Gusa, who is a counseling psychologist and heads up the Department of Psychology at the University of Pretoria. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, and thank you so much for having me.
Prof Gusa, you have had a two-pronged career. You started off as a counseling psychologist in private practice for 15 years, and then you transitioned into academia. During your tenure at the University of Johannesburg, you were instrumental in developing the first undergraduate module in positive psychology, and you served as head of the department at the University of Johannesburg from 2013 through to 2016. Going back in time, what were some of the reasons that you decided to become a psychologist?
It may sound strange, but I initially wanted to be a journalist. So it wasn't something I always wanted to do. I think I was interested in people and their experiences and their stories. But psychology was one of my subjects at university. And then the more I became involved in understanding the study of psychology, which is about human behavior, human thoughts, human feelings, that sort of pulled me in the direction. And then one thing led to the other. And then I decided, no, this is the career I want to really understand people. I want to be part of the journey towards healing for those who come for therapy. And I think it just spoke to who I am, to really look into people's lives and assist them in overcoming the obstacles that they are experiencing.
It's a very admirable career. And one thing I just want to tap into before we continue with this conversation is that often I think when people go to university that they are focused on studying that one clear path. Mm. And as you and several of our other guests have indicated, is that you may start off in one direction, but when you're exposed to other things, you then find your true calling.
I absolutely agree. And I think especially when you're young, we go to university, most of us at the age of 18, you are still susceptible to new ideas. You're still growing, you're still developing. And one should utilize these opportunities to really ask yourself, is this really what I want to do? I find it often that young people say, but my parents want me to become a lawyer or a doctor, whatever. And they do it, but it's not their true calling. So I was fortunate to be able to do this and to go into my true calling.
So going from journalism to psychology, then into counseling psychology as a career, what prompted you to transition over to the academic space?
Yes, I think in my heart, I was always an academic. I really enjoyed my studies. I did well. But at that time, my husband took a position in a town where there was no academic opportunity. So I went into private practice and I really enjoyed it. And I really think it developed me as a person. It was very meaningful. And then during that time, I did my PhD because I was a researcher at heart while I was doing my private practice. And the opportunity arose when we moved back to the city to enter the academic sphere. And from there onwards, I was really into the academic work in psychology, which I really love as well.
So again, it's tapping into those true callings of what speaks to the heart.
Yeah, and what you're ready for at a particular time of your life, I think it was really beneficial to have done the groundwork being a psychologist for so many years before returning to the academic sphere. Because at the moment, I'm very much involved in the training of counseling psychologists and clinical psychologists. So I have the background of what it means to sit for 7 hours a day working with our clients and to help them prepare for that work later on.
I'd imagine it must be quite draining as an individual because you're seeing people, you're exposed to their problems, their challenges, and you've probably got a degree of empathetic skills that are there. But I just often find that it must be quite a draining position to be in.
It is, exactly. It is. And especially when you start out as a young professional, it can be even more draining because we put so much expectations on ourselves to care for everybody and to help everybody. So, yes, it is draining. But fortunately, also through our training, we learn self-care. We know what to look forward for if we start to become overburdened. And I think relationships with close people, the ones that love us, also help us to balance out all these demands, emotional demands.
So moving on to career two, wearing your head of department cap for the psychology department at the University of Pretoria, can you tell us about some of the work that you do and the responsibilities that come with occupying this role?
Yes, it's a totally different role, but I would say I'm also caring. I'm caring for students, for staff, for the university, for the profession. But I think in my job description, they would say I'm responsible for academic leadership of the Department of Psychology. So it's about strategy. Where are we going? How are we developing as a discipline at the University of Pretoria? Are we positioning ourselves in terms of international developments? How relevant is our teaching in terms of national and international happenings in the field of psychology? So that sort of strategic work is important, but also managing staff, managing students, complaints come my way, you have to deal with that. So it's sort of having a bird's eye view of students and staff in the Department of Psychology, making sure everything runs smoothly and effectively.
And do you have any particular goals or objectives that you want to drive?
I think I've been in this role for about 6 years now, so I think I've reached a few things that were important to me. But I say there's a lot more to be done in terms of the content of our curriculum, specifically undergrad, that we need to move forward. I would say updating it, becoming more relevant to what is happening in the country, what is happening internationally. I think that is something I would like to work towards still. What I'm happy about is our professional training programs. We have recurriculated. They are looking good at the moment. So I'm happy about that. But I think undergrad we can still look at. And then obviously also always research to really strengthen the research output in our department. That's part of our job, a big part.
And what would you say are some of the most rewarding aspects of the role?
I think it's really. I enjoy being able to empower people because the way you manage, you can enable people, you can empower them, you can create an atmosphere where people want to work and where they feel that they can also live out their true calling. So that I enjoy. I'd like to believe that that's something that I do and that I enjoy. I also enjoy the international collaboration that comes with it, that I can collaborate with colleagues from other countries. I can initiate it being head of department. You can initiate initiatives to do international research. And definitely, I enjoy the mentoring of younger colleagues, being part of their road towards the next generation of psychologists and academics in psychology.
Speaking about the enabling aspect, the mentorship aspect, which are so incredibly important in terms of shaping people and giving them a crutch when they need it, apart from the technical skills, but sometimes it's those soft elements. Can you share some of your views about education as being a tool of empowerment, as enabler for women?
I think it's incredibly important. I think without education, you actually 2 foot or 2 steps back. With the education, I think comes the opportunities, comes also sometimes, I think, the trust and the confidence that you've got something to move forward. So I think this is a crucial aspect of empowering and equity for women going forward.
Reflecting on your own career for a moment, can you tell us, if it's not intruding on patient-client trust parameters, can you tell us about a couple of defining cases that have stood out for you?
Yes, of course, I'll have to be very careful because of patient confidentiality, of client confidentiality. But I think what stood out for me more often is that people would contact me after many years, and I may not have remembered all the detail of the case, but they said, that day you really listened to me and you helped me to understand me better. So I was able to go and make changes in my life. And that happened often. And that made me realize that it's so important to be present with every case. It may not feel like it's a case that stands out in the moment, but the impact you have on people's life is long-enduring, and we have the responsibility to create that space for them to be able to do that.
Sorry, let me rephrase this a little. Psychology is a very practical discipline. We've already spoken about the fact that you were a practitioner in counseling before you moved into the academic space 100%. What types of job opportunities are available to aspiring psychologists?
Okay. I think first and foremost, it's really important to say that unfortunately we only have a few psychologists graduating every year because we can only train about six in each category, six counseling, six clinical, so forth. So if you can imagine how few people graduate as psychologists and how many people take psychology as a major. Psychology undergraduate will not make you a psychologist. You need to study up till your master's degree. So to me, that is my issue sometimes, that people are sitting with or they have the undergraduate degree, but they cannot be psychologists. For those who can become psychologists after their master's training, some of them work in the Department of Health, but we know there are sometimes difficulties with posts and budget. Quite a few of them work there. Other people go into private practice or group practices. That is where the majority of psychologists would be working at the moment. These would be in group practices. Some work for organizations, some work also in NGOs, but I would say mostly find themselves in private practice at the moment.
And what's the representation like of women in psychology?
This is actually what's nice. Most psychologists in the country at the moment are women. So there's a huge, we call about the feminization of the profession. So you will find a lot of representativity there. I think because women are caring, women are compassionate, they tend to gravitate towards the profession.
It almost sounds, though, that we don't have enough practitioners.
We definitely don't. I think there's very much scope for more practitioners, and also maybe on what we call a more primary level. If you're not a psychologist, to be a registered counselor, there are some universities training what we call registered counselor, but there's still a need for more registered counselors. But it's the story of capacity of universities, capacity of training institutions, or where people do internships. So it's there are a lot of things to consider, but I agree, we need make much, much more.
Thanks for giving us an overview of the profession and what it takes and the different opportunities that are available if you are lucky enough to proceed. You're listening to Womanity, Woman in Unity, and today we're talking to Professor Tarina Khusa, who is a counseling psychologist and heads up the Department of Psychology at the University of Pretoria. We would love to receive your comments on Twitter at WomanityTalk. Prof. Khusa, in the previous part of our conversation, you mentioned that research was an important output of the department. Your research and teaching focuses on positive psychology broadly and well-being in particular. Can you give us an overview of what positive psychology is and how it differs from traditional psychology?
Yeah, somebody once said, now, is there a negative psychology? If there's a positive psychology, at least you say traditional. Yes, there isn't a negative psychology. But it's quite a relatively new field, say about 20, 25 years in the making. But the idea of positive psychology is not to replace traditional psychology, but to complement it by having a more, I would say, holistic view of clients, of people, of patients, because traditionally psychology has focused on what's going wrong, on the psychopathology, on the illness, on all these things that are important, but does not help us understand people in their complexity, because we also have joy and happiness and well-being. So positive psychology also studies these aspects of human functioning in conjunction with the sadness and the depression, so that we can get a broader view of what it's about to be human and how these factors work together in our functioning as people.
Is there a easy framework that one can latch on to?
In which sense? What do you mean by a
In
framework?
terms of thinking about positive psychology as some of the components that go into it. So you spoke, for instance, about kind of the more joyful emotions, as opposed to it's the end of my life and the world is just too overwhelming. So thinking about a potential framework that just helps differentiate.
The two. Yes, positive psychology is interested in understanding and identifying resources within people, strengths, for example, hope, gratitude. It's interested in how can we use these resources to help people overcome the current difficulties they may be having and function better and function optimally. We're trying to understand how can we get people, organizations, community to function at their best, taking into consideration there will always be obstacles and difficult things to overcome. So we're looking at a positive outcome in the end.
And it sounds as though you're using an individual or a business's own internal resources. So it kind of has more of a sustainable dynamic to it.
Yes. We're actually looking at internal resources, but also external, like what is there in the community that can support us, or what is in our relationships that can support us to overcome obstacles, and then also to use our best strengths or what is good inside ourselves. So I think it's quite a, excuse me, a systemic view, as you would say.
As a practical, as someone who has practice in counseling, what are some of the benefits of positive psychology?
I think positive psychology is very useful to help people focus not only on what is holding them back, but also what has worked on in the past that they can use again. Also, identifying, we found identifying your strengths, for example, it's one activity that we do, give people energy to move on and address the issues that may be bothering them at the moment. So it gives, I think, energy, it gives hope for people to focus on the things that are cumbersome or detrimental to their well-being at the moment. I think also in terms of counseling or therapy, positive psychology is also there for people who may want to develop their strengths and may not be suffering from a, say, for example, a depression or something that's really, really emotionally complicated at the moment. So that's also the other thing about positive psych. It can help people becoming the best version of themselves.
Very positive. Given all of your learnings, is there anything that you think, because we're a gender-based show, that is particularly relevant in the field that helps promote gender equality and well-being?
I think we're still at the beginning of really integrating positive psychology and gender studies. Although there's been lots of research that showed that there are gender differences in aspects of well-being. Men, for example, seem to value autonomy more, whereas women value compassion and kindness, these type of strengths more, which I think is natural and is okay. So we must actually celebrate our specific strengths and utilize them in our lives. Another study, for example, showed that in workplaces where there is definite attempts or policies to promote gender equality, women are happier, they function better, their well-being is higher. So I think on a policy level, if organizations, for example, can work towards that, that can help women experience well-being in the workplace as well.
I read about some of your research projects, looking at, for instance, focusing on hope and gratitude as psychological strengths across the lifespan. And you're also one of the International Hope Barometer research. So you're also one of the lead researchers on the International Hope Barometer research program. What is the Hope Barometer?
That is a really fascinating project that I really love being part of. It is an annual survey, as we send it out in November of each year, that measures people's hopes and expectations for the coming year, but also how much their hopes were fulfilled in the year that's passed. Depending on context, every year we may add other questions. For example, during COVID, we added questions about coping and post-traumatic growth. When the Ukraine war started, we added questions about attitudes towards war and to see how that correlates. For example, what's the relationship between hope and attitudes towards war? So that is the questionnaire that goes out, and there are 13 countries at the moment. We continue to expand, but the core researchers are the principal researcher in Switzerland, Andreas Kraft, myself, and colleagues in Czech Republic and Portugal. That's the core team. And then we've had people, researchers joining us from Colombia, for example, Nigeria, Australia, the UK, a lot of other European countries as well, and India.
So, with 13 countries in the mix, are you seeing any trends, for instance, from an African perspective versus a European perspective on what hope means?
What we actually did is we evaluated levels of hope. In other words, how high people's levels of or feeling of hope was during different times. And interestingly, during COVID, we felt that the African countries, it was Nigeria and South Africa only, showed higher levels of hope and well-being than the European countries, for example. And constantly, it seems like African countries have high levels of hope, which seems to stem from a trust in resources in the community, in the people around us, and also faith-based trust that seems to support hope in the African continent, at least.
So there's a bit of a collectivist dynamic.
Exactly. Exactly.
Many years ago, we had the opportunity to interview President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf from Liberia, and I asked her a question about, what was the impact that she felt she'd made to the country, thinking she's going to talk about infrastructure and other tangible elements. And she said, giving hope to a nation in despair. And it's something which has just stayed with me as being so powerful.
Exactly. And I think this is important in our context, along the continent, across the continent.
So that's the Hope Barometer. Can you tell us about some of your other research projects and work with local or international collaborations?
At the moment, most of my international work is on the Hope Barometer. I've done work, more sort of teaching exchanges with a colleague at the University of Bologna, where we've been training students on well-being, on understanding well-being interventions to increase well-being. That was also really powerful. I enjoyed that very much. But my most recent research, I think, would be all mostly about the Hope Barometer, because we've got so much data over the past 7 years that needs to be done.
And how do you use that data?
What we actually do is we start to look at what we have, what research questions we have, and then analyze, write it up, publish. So that's basically what we're about. Some of my research students also analyze some of the data. For example, my one student analyzed data to see whether there are differences in where our hope come from, depending on how old we are. And it seems like older people seem to find more hope in religious experiences than younger people, which we can expect. I think older people tend to be more religious in any case. So that's the type of questions we ask, and then we analyze the data and go forward.
It sounds like a fascinating project with so many variables and opportunities to come out of it.
Yeah, lots to be done still.
So we've spoken about the profession, we've spoken about some of your research projects. Turning towards you as an individual and thinking about the busy roles that you occupy, one of the because one of those challenging components that comes out of gender equality principles is the idea of achieving work-life balance. And you are a busy professional who's worked incredibly hard to build your successful career. What are some of your views about managing the dynamic between home and work?
I think that will always be difficult. And sometimes when I look back, I ask myself, but how did you do it? Because in the moment, I didn't think I just did it, you know, raising a child, commuting, doing research. I think there's a lot on women's shoulders in terms of work-life balance, and especially if you want to have a career as well. So it's not easy. And I think there are women who have many more struggles than I have. I think I've been fortunate in the way things panned out for me. But I have a lot of empathy with my colleagues who have got small children and have to publish and have to teach. I really think it's not an easy feat to achieve. What worked for me was really to simply acknowledge that it's difficult and do the best you can at a particular time. Sometimes you will be able to have more of a balance. Sometimes work may ask more of you and you need to focus there. Sometimes how the home environment asks you for more time when your child is sick or when your parents need your assistance with something, you need to put aside the work and give attention to that. And that creates tension. That always creates tension, but we do the best we can.
It's one of the first times that we've heard people speak about not just the issue of looking after children, but also looking after elderly parents, because you're right, it is that same care dynamic that needs to be delivered in family environments. Can you share your top three suggestions as tips for women to perhaps juggle better? Because I think it's always going to be a juggle.
Yeah, it's always going to be a juggle. And I think for me, the first thing is not to be scared to say no. As women, we don't want to say no if somebody to ask us to do something or there's another career opportunity, because there comes a point where you will not be able to do everything. So rather be very careful for what you commit yourself to than to say no to say yes to everything. I've learned it the hard way sometimes that you become overburdened. I think that's important. Secondly, is to utilize the support you have around you, supportive relationships. It can be your husband or your partner, it can be friends, it can be colleagues, it can be a mentor that you can just soundboard with so that you can get a bit of perspective that can help you also balance and juggle better. And I think also to not think you have to be perfect all the time because you're not going to be. As I say, there will be times when you are really doing well in one aspect of your life, but the other one is not doing so great, but that's part of being human.
I think that last piece is also, all of them are absolutely important. The ability to say no and create your boundaries. Saying yes to help and support to enable you. And the last one on perfectionism, it's chasing a fallacy. Nothing is perfect.
Absolutely.
One question that I ask all my guests on the show is about some of the factors that they feel have contributed to their success. So some people speak about faith, a particular person, perseverance, values. In your view, what have been some of the key drivers to your success?
I think definitely perseverance. I think I'm inclined to just when I set my mind to something, I do it and I finish it. I've been able to do most of that. I think a good dose of curiosity about my subject. about the world. If I wasn't so curious, I would have stopped long ago with the research. And even the work as a psychologist, we have to be curious about our clients and how we can help them. So I would say that passion for psychology also pulled me forward. But all of that, I think, wouldn't have helped the curiosity, the perseverance without a solid support system, which I've been lucky to have throughout my life, from my parents, my husband, my son as he grew older. So I think that helps as well.
Thanks for sharing some of the ingredients in your recipe, because everybody's cake mix is different.
Different, yes, absolutely.
Hindsight is 20/20 vision. So if you had an opportunity to redo anything, what would you change and how would you go about doing it?
I thought long and hard about this. And honestly, I don't think there's something I've got a burning desire to change. Because if I look back, everything that happened in my life or every choice I made worked out for the better, or it contributed to my development as a person. The only thing is, I could have maybe entered the academic world a bit earlier, because I love my research so much, but I would have lost the richness of the practice experience. So no, I think I just say everything was meaningful and worthwhile.
And I think also in your response, it's about making the best of your circumstances, of your situation, and that lived reality at that point in time.
I think so, because somebody once asked me a few years ago, but what is your plan for the next 10 years? And I honestly didn't set plans that by now I wanted to be head of department. Things evolve, and I took the opportunities how it came along and just made the best of it. And I think sometimes going that way worked better for me than to have set ideas of a career that has to happen in a certain manner.
Just on that notion of heading up department and leadership, what would you say are some of your leadership strategies that have been most effective?
I think what was helpful is, because I was a psychologist, it really helps for me to create an environment of being an enabler, of support, of understanding that the people working in my department are people too. They're not just workers, you know, to try and keep the human kind or the compassion going. I think that is important. But also the way you talk, if you talk, and that comes from my positive psychology, if you talk about hope, about positive things, about shared goals, you also help people to move forward than to use a stick and to threaten and to be the boss and the person in power. So I think that's my leadership style, is enabling and collaborative and supportive.
And it really takes on and draws on the skills of your discipline too.
Yes, I think so.
And as you were growing up, can you tell us about some pivotal moments that impacted on you?
That sometimes feels so long ago, but I really grew up very, what's the right word? Uncomplicated. I had an uncomplicated childhood growing up on a small farm, grandparents living close by. So I had a lot of support there, a lot of wonderful experiences in nature. And I think these relationships helped me to really develop into the best person I could be over time. I think there was always that support from my parents' side. So being in nature, being on a farm, that was great.
Oh, to hark back to simpler days, I could run away there right now.
Yes, absolutely.
And can you tell us about a few of the strong female role models in your life?
I think I can divide them on the professional side and also on a personal side. I had a very strong role model professionally in the person at the university. I studied at Northwest University, who was my supervisor for my master's and PhD, Professor Marie Wissing. She's also seen as one of the main, how can I put it? She is the person that developed positive psychology in South Africa from the early 2000s, and she's internationally acclaimed. So I think she was my role model, because she was also supportive, enabling, empowering, but also a very good academic. You could always talk to her. She was always open, always warm, you know. But the way that she also combined this with a very solid research focus, academic strengths that inspired me to also go the academic route. And we still have contact. We still work together after about 35 years. We still have that contact.
That's an enduring relationship. And any other women that stand out for you besides the professional space?
Yeah, and I think other than that, it would be in my family, it would be my maternal grandmother who always saw the best in everybody. And there was this one song from ABBA, if people remember ABBA, that says, "Something good in everything I see." My grandmother used to sing that, and that stuck with me. And I think in the end, that's why I studied what I did.
That's a wonderful story. And lastly, as we close out today's show, please can you share a few words of inspiration or motivation that you'd like to pass on to girls and women who are listening to us on the continent?
I think being a researcher on hope, I would like to maybe emphasize the power of hope. Hope helps us to move forward. If we look at the future as something that's going to come and overwhelm us, it will be difficult to go forward. But if we go with hope, we say, I can do something. I've got the agency. I can find resources in myself or around myself. I know it's difficult, but I have a hope that something that's important to me will in the end materialize. So I would like to encourage them to have that hope and utilize the resources that they will have.
Thank you very much for that fantastic message. And it's a small word, but it has such huge connotations for everybody. It really speaks to us all. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for the opportunity. I really enjoyed it as well.
You have been listening to Womanity, Women in Unity, and we have been talking to Professor Tarina Gusa, who is a counseling psychologist and heads up the Department of Psychology at the University of Pretoria.